Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Miroslav Volf grew up in communist Yugoslavia to parents who had been subjected to persecution for their faith. Later in life, he was to be interrogated and persecuted for his own faith. He went on to become the founding director for the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, where he is now recognized as one of the world's finest systematic theologians. Professor Volf's book, Exclusion and Embrace, received global accolades for its conclusions around forgiveness and reconciliation, later followed by A Public Faith, laying out a map for practically living our faith in a multi-faith world. We commenced our conversation with the professor around his childhood reflections on faith, as reflected by his parents.
It's interesting because there was a kind of a very powerful and quiet kind of faith. My father was a Pentecostal minister, and you might expect sometimes a rather sturdy and aggressive forms of expressions of faith, and yet it was a very quiet faith. I think it was an expression of the fact that it was not, in a sense, he who sought after God, but notwithstanding his incredible rebellion against God on account of having suffered as an innocent man, God somehow found him, and God's love overpowered him. And I think that moment defined his whole personality, his whole attitude toward faith in general. And so it was almost more of a struggle for the purity of one's own soul and for the purity of the relationship with God than it is anything than it was anything else. And that, I think, gave certain genuineness, absence of hypocrisy to his faith. My mother was like that as well, which was actually amazing. And when I think about it, what I pushed against was less some kind of overbearing, rough-edged faith that was kind of cramping me down. It was more that this something beautiful that they have was too heavy, too hard for me to carry, and I wasn't able to do so. So it was never real rebellion. It was more like disappointment with myself combined with desire for something outside that made it impossible for me to embrace that faith. In other words, beautiful faith forged under amazingly hard circumstances.
Professor, while your parents had long since reconciled their treatment by the government of the day for having a faith, you were later to be captured and interrogated by the same government for the same reason. Did that further frame your understanding of reconciliation personally?
You know, I think it was basically at work all along there, and was at work when my young brother died at the age of five on account of negligence of a soldier, and the forgiveness that my parents extended, and it kind of defined their whole life. And obviously, once I engaged actively in active Christian life, adverse circumstances were always there. And so when I came to the point where I was being interrogated myself, interrogated maybe less for the purposes of actually abandoning faith and more for the purposes of becoming an informer, betraying some people, I found that kind of the practices that my parents have taught me have kind of stuck. They were with me. They were part of who I was, and they surfaced in those moments as something that I needed to do, that I needed to struggle in order to be able to do, notwithstanding the inner urge to do otherwise.
Professor, in your much-awarded Exclusion and Embrace work of the mid-90s, you explore the connection between forgiveness and reconciliation and the chances of victims becoming perpetrators later in life and the role that forgiveness plays in breaking that chain. Here in Australia, there are a number of royal commissions into the role of organised faith in the abuse of small children. In your experience as one who's had to find forgiveness for atrocities committed against you, what insights would you have for those victims of this early childhood abuse in 2014 in Australia?
Yeah, and that's especially difficult issue when the church, whether as an institution or individuals that identify with the church, have been the perpetrators. And I think they're the first order of the day is that of Christian repentance and simple standing by the kind of the mark of evil that that mars our history, and making sure that we recognize it, we distance ourselves, and we apologize. That's almost like a first step toward forgiveness. I think, and even then, of course, forgiveness is always a gift. It's not something that apology elicits, something that apology makes maybe easier. It has to be given as an act of grace. And how that grace happens and why that grace happens, that's a long subject to explore. My sense is that we are able to forgive when we know that we ourselves are accepted, that our wounds have not touched the very core of our existence, but that those wounds have deeply hurt us, and yet that at the core of it we are held, we are protected, we are assured. And I think that that was my experience, right? My experience was that no matter what Yugoslavian government officials and military officials did to me, how horrendous it was and how trembling my body and soul always was in those occasions, that ultimately they couldn't touch the heart of who I was, and that at the heart of who I was this beloved child of God.
Professor, as a man who's had to find forgiveness for another, is the act of forgiveness a predictable sequence of steps, much like the stages of grief, perhaps? Or is it unique to each of us as individuals and relative to other factors, for instance, the crimes committed against us or the people perpetrating those crimes?
I think we each forgive in a way in which is appropriate to us as persons. Each forgiveness is its own type of kind of forgiveness, because each story is unique and each personality is unique. I think there are also elements that are common, and these elements that are common is the victim doesn't count. What was done against it, against him or her, against the perpetrator. Perpetrator apologizes and apologizes with sincerity, recasts the whole relationship and reaffirms the moral order, and it's his or her willingness to abide by this. So there's some common elements to forgiveness, and each story will be unique, and also capacity of different people will be different, and we simply have to have patience with the pace at which people can come to embody fully forgiveness, especially as we know that even those victims who forgive, they forgive during the day, and during the night they take it back, and then during the day they forgive again and then take it back again. It has happened to me many times.
Key barriers to forgiveness would include judgmentalism and the fear of compromise. Are there others that are foremost in your mind, in your experience, that perhaps might get in the way to that transition to reconciliation?
Yeah, kind of sense of also kind of the holding on to hurt, right? Because often as victims, we draw our identity from the very fact that we have been hurt, and not just that we draw our identity, but we draw also our power from that. And we feel that if we forgive, we will relinquish our power over the perpetrator. That's an understandable propensity, because to be violated means to be in this powerless situation and on account of powerlessness to suffer, right? And so often we are unwilling to forgive because we want to hold on to this, to hold responsible the other person. And in a sense, the unforgiveness becomes, in a sense, our own punishment and our own form of revenge against the other person.
Is reconciliation an automatic outcome, a byproduct of forgiveness, or is that a separate stage that we need to look at as an entity in and of itself?
I think it's a distinct step. I think they're integrated and connected, but reconciliation itself, forgiveness basically, I think, takes care of the past and thus opens up a way toward the future. But reconciliation also depends on the ability of both parties to trust each other, not only to have the hurt removed or have some agreement of what has happened and how it needs to be attended, but also to be able to project their lives into the future, to trust that the other person will not repeat the offense, and thus to be able to walk together. That's what reconciliation is. We face each other, stand next to each other, and walk together into the future. And forgiveness as such will help that, but will not make it possible without building of trust.
Professor, in your conversation with Yale University students last year, mostly youth pastors and leaders, you cover off a life worth living. What does a life worth living look like in 2014?
Depending how deep down do you want to go, ultimately, I think it's very simple. Life worth living, or life gains its worth by being loved, and love gains us being loved, and life gains the worth by us loving. So receiving and giving love, I think, is kind of fundamental to life being worth living. It's then the question, how do we, in a particular context in which we find ourselves today, how do we express this? How do we experience that? How do we live that very deep and simple and deep truth in our lives out? Often people talk about love as an important component of life worth living, but they concentrate primarily on love that we give to others, which is wonderful too. But I think almost as important, and in Christian faith, in many ways even more important than love given, is actually love received, which is a condition of possibility of leading a life worth living. And basically, it's an expression of the goodness of the creation, the goodness of our own lives, that it is, as it is, affirmed notwithstanding all its difficulties.
Professor, moving on to your book of 2011, A Public Faith, in a way it comes back to the beginning of our conversation today, and that is how we as Christians, people of faith, engage with our world. And if biblically we are asked to become the salt of our community, how do we both become that point of agitation as well as seek a unified community as an outcome, an expression of our faith, bringing people together where at the heart of it, perhaps, we're asked to prove as a point of friction?
Living in a pluralistic world means that there are going to be frictions there. There are differences there, and these differences will serve both to enrich us, but they will also serve to kind of push back at us. And in that sense, I think it's not an easy life in community is never easy. If you're very different, often becomes more difficult, especially if you live, as we often do, under a single roof. And I think for the Christians, it's probably just as I would say for anybody else, it's important to, above all, to embody our faith rather than kind of articulate it in the face of others. I'm not against articulation, but if it's not backed by embodiment, it becomes a kind of obnoxious faith. To serve others, to have a certain light touch, I think to be genuine. Hypocrisy is such an important obstacle to us being effective in the public realm. It's amazing how attractive people who are genuine about their own state, about weaknesses, and yet deeply committed to some good are. It's not easy to find people like that, but they point us in the direction in which we can live our lives of peace in the midst of debates and discussions that mark our pluralistic world.
Professor, before we wrap up, I should declare that Australians as a nation are a fairly competitive lot. We don't like to come second to anyone. Who are the countries, who are the leaders in the world who have a handle on this living a common good-focused lifestyle as a nation, as a community?
Oh, wow, that's a very great question, and I'll have to think about this. I'm not sure. From what I read, Australians are doing rather well. All the reports that one reads from the kind of widely accepted measurements, I'm not always sure that widely accepted measurements are also aligned with measurements that are rooted in the Christian faith. But nonetheless, Australia has a great reputation.
That's an interesting observation. I was going to head there in a moment, but let's start there now. When it comes to a nation's relative success to others, they're often quantified by virtues of GDP and growth and the medical coverage available for the broader community. What are the differentiating factors between what we accept at an economic or a governmental level as divergent from the biblical text?
Take something like gross national product. It seems like almost utterly irrelevant from the Christian standpoint, right? In terms of how much wealth a country produces, without any that we measure our standing by how much wealth we produce. Second, that we measure it kind of irrespectively of its distribution, that we measure it irrespective of whether it's being produced by preventing crime or actually investing in the particular positive projects, for instance. All of these things, I think, from the Christian standpoint, are rather questionable, right? So. It would be a great challenge for, I think, not just Christians, but others who think alike, and a number of people have undertaken that, to think about alternative ways in which we can express something so that express the achievement, economic achievements of a country that are much more attuned to what is happening in concrete lives of people and how their lives and open and possibilities of their living better lives is enhanced.
Professor, by way of summation, can I ask you which precept above all else you cherish most and how you implement that on a daily basis?
That's a wonderful question. I think my sense has been that Christian life is the one of following Jesus. And my sense has been that at the heart of Jesus' teaching with regard to how we relate to others is do unto others as you want others to do unto you. And between the concrete steps of following Jesus and his example and this more formal principle that he has given, I think that's where our lives need to move. How have I done it in my own life? I'm trying to nurture my attachment to Jesus Christ as the key to humanity, and trying to think through, what does it mean to be a follower of Christ here and now in the circumstances in which I have been placed with the calling which I think that I have been given?
Professor Miroslav Volf, thank you so much for what has been a fascinating conversation. Looking forward to hearing more from you as the keynote speaker at Rethinking a Public Faith, the 2014 Richard Johnson Lecture. It's happening in Sydney. Details at richardjohnson.com.au right now.
My pleasure.